free, young hearts run free, young hearts run free, young hearts run free, young hearts run free! Welcome to the Young Hearts Run Free podcast. This is episode 86. And the reason I mention the number 86 is this is a very special episode of the podcast, isn't it, Stephen?
It sure is, John. It's an extra special edition.
Yes, a special edition because this episode of the Young Hearts Run Free podcast is specifically going to be about the Barclay Marathons. The Barclay Marathons first took place in Frozen Head State Park near Wartburg, Tennessee in 1986. You see, it's an 86. So we are going to be going for the very first time transatlantic, and we're going to be speaking with a well-kent face of the Barclay Marathons, aren't we, Stephen?
We are indeed. We had the privilege to speak to Frozen Ed Furtaugh, our first ever transatlantic guest on the Young Hearts Run Free podcast. And in last week's episode, we heard from Graham Connolly, who gave us a wee bit of an intro into who Frozen Ed is. And he called him one of the legacy geezers from Barclay.
That's right. And just think about it, listeners. Frozen Head State Park, Frozen Ed Furtaugh. There's a wee link there that will be revealed by the man himself, when we get chatting to him. Stephen's just mentioned Graham Connolly. Graham Connolly was in the campsite this year at the Barclay Marathons and took it upon himself to introduce himself and put us, thankfully, in touch with the man himself. We are eternally grateful to Graham for making this happen. We're also eternally grateful to Ed for taking the time to speak with us. Normally, if you're already a listener, you will know about the highly polished quality that we put out. Now, this episode is going to be in its raw form. We had to tweak a wee things because it was, it's the first time we'd done a transatlantic call. How do we record this? We normally record over a sort of video platform. This wasn't that. This was simply a phone call. So we knew it might be a one-off opportunity to get this. Hopefully not. Hopefully we can speak with Ed again in the future. But let's just say we were up to high though about hopefully it's going to record all right. So there's no bells and whistles. It is as it was.
Yeah, absolutely that. It's stripped back and authentic. It's our chat with Frozen Ed Furtaugh, and we're going to get some tales from out there.
Hello, this is Ed.
Hello, Ed. It's John Cassidy. How you doing?
Okay, I'm doing great. Did you say John Cassidy?
Yes, and also got Stephen Watt here as well.
Okay.
We're phoning you from Scotland. We're the Young Hearts Run Free podcast.
All right. That's great. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ed. I'm Stephen. I'm also in the room with John just now in our little recording studio.
Okay. Are you guys both runners?
Stephen more so than me. I'm more of a run walker, Ed.
Okay. Well, me too. Now that I'm 74 years old, most of what I still call running is actually walking.
Yeah. Well, I am. John is discrediting himself. He also runs. John's tackling an ultra marathon this weekend.
Ah, nice.
So he is in fine shape, and for my part, I am travelling over to the US on the 18th of April to participate in the Boston Marathon.
Oh, good for you. Good luck.
Yeah, thank you.
That's a very famous race. Yeah. Be ready for a huge crowd.
Yeah, I'm all set. I've been disciplined with my training, so I'm ready to fly.
Good.
But listen, Ed, can I just check, are you okay with our accents?
Couldn't quite understand what you said.
Okay, I think maybe you're having a laugh, but that's all right. what I was going to say is we want to speak with you about a place that isn't quite so crowded as Boston. We want to speak with you about the Barclay Marathons, if that's okay.
Yes, that's what I was hoping for.
Yeah.
And we heard that you caught up with our ace in the pack, Mr. Graham Connolly.
Yeah, Graham, he felt really, really privileged to have met you and spoken to you on the ground at the camp and stuff.
Yeah. I enjoyed that. Is he the one I'm thinking of who is on it? He's in the Navy, he's on a submarine?
Yeah, he said that his wee submarine gift to you is on its way.
Well, I was so amazed to meet another submariner at the Barclay.
Well, he's the man.
I happened to be on the submarine just for a few months back in 1968.
Wow. And well, I think we're not wanting to go quite far as back as that, but what we've been looking at your book, Tales from Out There, the Barclay Marathon, and what we'd like to know, a lot of people hear about the Barclay Marathon these days and they see it on social media and on Netflix, but what we'd really love to know, Ed, is about Barclay in the early days. And I do believe, were you there right at the very beginning?
Almost. I first ran the Barclay in 1988. That was the third year of the event. And one of the things that attracted me to it was that no one finished it in the first 2 years. So, you know, at the time, Laz was just calling it 50 miles, and it had a 24-hour time limit. And I was running 50-mile races in between 7 and 9 hours. And I was thinking, what is wrong with those people? They can't run 50 miles in 24 hours?
Okay. So I decided...
So I decided I was going to do it.
Cool. Can I ask, where are you in America with regards to where the Barclay Marathons take place?
Well, right now I live in Virginia. At the time, in 1988, I lived in North Carolina. It was about a 7-hour drive from Frozen Head.
Okay.
So I went to Frozen Head several times to train for the race and kind of fell in love with it.
Yeah. And now that you've mentioned Frozen Head, is that where Frozen Ed comes from?
Yes. Uh-huh. Yeah, right from the start. Okay, so in the first few years of the Barclay, Laz, who at the time was still known by his real name, Gary Cantrell, he was actually soliciting runners to come and run it. He wasn't getting very many applicants the first few years. I think in the first 4 years of the race, there were an average of about 16 runners per year. So it was a very small event, and I think a lot of people were, you know, kind of put off by something that no one could do. But that's what attracted me to it. I just wanted to see if I could do it.
Yeah.
And indeed, I did. I finished it in my first attempt in 1988. At the time, he was calling it 55 miles, and it had a 36-hour time limit. But it was really only someone else's bad luck that allowed me to actually be the winner. And that the other person that was there who made a serious attempt at it was Tom Possert. Tom was a world-class runner, especially in long adventure runs. And it took me 34 hours to finish the Barclay that year, but Tom almost finished it in 24 hours. The problem was that he had skipped part of the course, so he was disqualified. I don't think he was attempting to cheat. He just didn't understand some of Laz's instructions, and he thought going up to a mountaintop and back down was optional, but it was part of the course that Laz intended everyone to do, and he skipped it, so he was disqualified. Really, all it did was it only cut maybe less than 2 miles off the distance he ran. So Tom should have been the winner. He was clearly the superior runner there compared to me, But like I say, it was a stroke of bad luck for him and good luck for me. I was going to finish it regardless of whether I won it or not. It was just good luck for me to win it. But I accomplished what I set out to do, which was to prove that I could do it.
Fantastic. And can I ask a quick question, Ed? How did you come to find out about the race from Laz? You said that he was almost soliciting it to the running community. Did you stumble across it?
Okay. Well, I started running ultra marathons in 1983. And at the time, I quickly learned that there was a magazine that originated in about 1981, published in the United States, called Ultra Running Magazine. And so I subscribed to that starting in 1984. And at the back of the magazine every month, they had a list of events, just the event calendar. And the Barclay was listed in there. So I knew about it even before the very first running of it. And I was familiar with Gary Cantrell because he was one of the regular writers who wrote, like a one-page column or article in just about every issue of Ultra Running Magazine. And he still does, maybe every other issue nowadays, but he's an excellent writer. So I became familiar with his name. I met him in 1986. And at the time, one of the other things he organized, besides the Barclay, was a series of ultra marathons called the Southern Ultra Grand Prix Series. It was eight events over a nine-month span. And I decided to run that. And so I was running a lot of ultras in those days. I think I ran nine ultras one year and maybe eight the next. I've always loved to run, and so when I discovered ultra marathons, I just took off and started running a lot of them. But that was where I learned about the Barclay, by seeing it listed in the ultra running event calendar. And then when I met Gary Cantrell that same year, 1986, the year of the first first Barclay, he was trying to coax runners to come and try that. So finally I took up the challenge, and I'm glad I did.
Yeah, well, so are we all, to be honest. In terms of the race then, thinking back to 1988, if you can, I can hardly remember what happened last week, Ed. What was it like on the ground at that time at Frozen Head?
Okay, in 1988... there was only about 16 or 18 of us starting, but there were some good runners. The guy I mentioned, Tom Poster, another top runner who was there was Eric Clifton. But the event was very small and low-key. Uh-huh. It started and ended in a campground, which it still does, and it took everybody about 6 hours or more to do each loop. So the people left in camp, they were kind of bored, I guess. Nothing for them to do in between, while the runners were out there. And so we were out there for hours at a time.
Yeah.
At the early on, he did allow runners to have what they called drop boxes, where we could put stuff in a bag or a box, and they actually transported them up in a truck up into the mountains, so that there were two places on the course where we could get aid from our own drop bags. And but eventually he cut that out and just started putting out water bottles, so runners were not allowed to get aid. But in the first few years that I ran it, they were allowing aid to be placed up in the mountains.
Okay.
When I finished the race in 1988, there was no celebration at the finish line because there was literally almost no one there. I got back into camp and I was, you know, kind of feeling like a hero. and I got up to where the gate is, and there was just a woman and two small children camping there. Well, that was the wife and children of Raw Dog Hen. Raw Dog is Gary Cantrell's co-conspirator who helps create the Barkley Marathon. But I don't think I had met her before the race, so, you know, I kind of introduced myself when I got to the finish and said, "Where is everybody?" and Kathy Hand told me, "Oh, they all got in a truck to go out and pick up the aid bags." So my wife and Gary and Raw Dog, they were up in the mountains in a pickup truck to retrieve the aid drop supplies. So I had to wait for them to get back, and then Gary gave me the trophy. It was a pewter mug that had been the drinking mug of his friend Barry Barkley, after whom the Barkley Marathons is named. It's named after a friend of Laz. I'm going to call him Laz now, because eventually he kind of started going by the name Lazarus Lake. But back in those old days, he was known as Gary Cantrell. So anyway, I received this trophy, which was intended to be a traveling cup that each year the winner of the race would get their name inscribed on it. And it had already been inscribed with the numbers 1986-0. 1987-0.
Ah,
so wonderful. I took the cup and I took it to an engraver and had it engraved, you know, 1988, Ed
Furtaugh. Brilliant. Quite right, too. Are you still the proud owner of that mug?
Oh, well, the original, that mug, it was circulated among the winners of the fun run. Every year, until several years later, when one of the runners refused to return it. He said he earned it and he was going to keep it. So the cup disappeared.
Okay.
Okay.
Now, you mentioned, can
okay,
I ask?
I should mention, go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, what I was going to ask, Ed, was you mentioned the words there, fun run. Do you want to describe what the fun run is, please?
Okay, yes. So for the first 3 years, 86, 87, and 1988, the only race was three loops around the park. Then, after Tom Posser proved that it could be done in about 24 hours, and I proved that even a mediocre runner could do it in under 36 hours, Lazarus declared the existence of the 100-mile Barkley Marathons. And he has claimed ever since that that was his original intention, was for it to be a 100-mile race. So starting in 1989, the fourth year of the event, he was calling the 100-mile the real race, and the three-loop race was the fun run.
Brilliant. You will always be the first ever winner of the Barkley Marathon.
Yes.
Brilliant.
Yes, I do consider myself the first. I was the first winner of it, and I was the first finisher of the race. But then the next year, that he did create the 100-mile race, which was six loops. And if you've read my book, Tales from Out There, all into the latter part of it, I explain how no one ever finished that course. The six loop 100-mile race. No one even took it seriously. No one ever even made a substantial effort to do four loops. And so after a number of years of that, he lengthened the loop, calling the fun run now 60 miles, and each loop 20 miles. Therefore, 100 miles became five loops instead of six. So starting in that very first year that was the layout of the race, that was 1995, a gentleman from England Mark Williams. He was a fell runner and a very good runner. He had run the Spartathlon, which is something like a 150-mile race through mountains in Greece. But he came to the United States. He had never been to Frozen Head before. He just, I think, did a little hiking to explore some of the trails the day before the race. And then he proceeded to do what no one thought was possible. He finished the Barkley 100-mile race in 59 and a half hours.
Wow.
So he was the one who really made it go from the seeming impossible to being something that, yes, there are people out there who can do that.
And what do you think happened?
We were all amazed. And just to show you how tough that was 1995. It wasn't until 2001, 6 years later, that anybody else finished that five-loop 100-mile race.
Okay. And what do you think was different for Mark Williams? Was it a good year for him, or was it something special that he did to finish?
Well, he wrote a little article that appeared in Ultra Running magazine, you know, which kind of blew my mind, because he was talking about doing back-to-back runs on the weekend in which he did 25,000 feet of climb.
Jeez.
Now, I don't know if you or whoever might be listening to this podcast has any idea what that is, what that's like. It's almost impossible. And to me, the most I ever did in a week of training for Barkley was about 11,000 feet of climb. So here was this guy doing 25,000 or more feet. He did 25,000 feet of climb in a weekend. So clearly he was head and shoulders tougher than I was. And I don't even know if any of the top American runners were doing that kind of training back then. But I think it showed the way of what it takes to do a race. Now, at the time, each loop had on the order of 8,000 feet of climb and 8,000 feet of descent. Laz always likes to try to make it sound easy by saying, there is no net elevation gain. Why is this so hard? But of course, by net elevation, you know, it's because there's the same amount of descent as there is of ascent. So it's always net zero, but but the amount of climb, it started out at about 8,000 feet per loop. And one of the things that he has done over the years is to increase that amount of vert, what I call vert, the vertical gain, and is now over 13,000 feet of vert per loop. So five loops of that, and you say, well, do the math, what's that?
80.
What's 13 times 5?
65.
80. Something like that.
65, Josh.
65,000 feet of climb. I think I'm getting that right.
So yeah, you are.
100 miles race. It now has 65,000 feet of climb.
Okay, so
it's crazy.
Two times Everest and a bit.
Pardon me?
So two times the height of Everest from sea level, plus a little bit extra.
Oh, yeah, that's right. I think Everest is 29,000 or something.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's what it is.
That's amazing. So, yeah, we were going to ask how... Yeah, go for it, Ed.
I was just going to say that clearly is one of the factors that makes this race so difficult. And the fact that he has had to make it tougher over the years. Remember, in those first few years, nobody could do it. But now runners have been able to do it. Not many, I might add. Only 15 different men, 18 different times total have finished the race. But he has to keep making it harder and harder to keep it at the limit of what's possible. And I don't know if you saw the documentary movie about the Barkley.
Yeah.
That was filmed in 2012, 10 years ago. And it came out to the public on Netflix in about 2015. And Laz says clearly in there why this thing is so difficult. It's because, as he said, he is trying to keep it at the limit of what's possible. And so, I mean, just think about that. That's a profound concept, that he is adjusting the difficulty of this event to keep it at the limits of what's possible. So, I mean, it's amazing to me that there's hundreds of people every year who are clamoring to get into this thing. He can only take 40 runners, so most people get frustrated because they can't go attempt it. But what is it that draws people to do something that's at the limit of what's humanly possible? I mean, it's like we're begging for suffering.
It's an interesting psychological discussion, isn't it? Just the let's put ourselves in the worst place possible, but actually sign up to do it.
It definitely has a philosophical or psychological attraction, but in order to enjoy it, you have to kind of be able to redefine failure. You go out because you can train like crazy and, you know, just put yourself at the limit. What last this year on the t-shirt, he calls the Berkeley Marathons, running at the red line, running on the red line. I think it's a reference to, in car racing, the tachometer, the speedometer, you know, has a red line and you're not supposed to exceed. So that's kind of what running at the Barclay is. It just takes everything you have to keep moving. And then when you do that and fail to complete the event, you have to, in order to live with yourself, you have to be able to redefine failure and say, I didn't fail because I was brave enough to attempt it. And the fact that nobody does it, nobody can do it, you know, it's been now 5 years since John Kelly was the last finisher of the Barclay 100. But people keep going back, and more world-class runners are drawn to it. This year's field was incredible. John Kelly was there. Carl Saba, the Belgian runner, who has set many records. Harvey Lewis, the big backyard champion, and Courtney Dowalter. I mean, there were so many really great runners there this year, and no one finished.
Yeah.
It's because it's at that limit of what's possible, and there was bad enough weather this year. It rained heavily during the first night of the race.
Yeah.
You know, and that caused a lot of the runners to drop out, and other people made mental mistakes, navigation errors, couldn't find books, or lost their pages. Part of how Laz makes sure each runner completed the proper course is they hide books on the course a few weeks before the race, and then during the race, each runner has to go to each book in order and tear out their page that corresponds to their bib number. This year there were 14 books on the course. So runners have to come back into camp and show Laz their 14 pages before they'll be allowed to continue on the next lap. But there was one case, a runner, I guess she had them in her pages in her pocket or in a bag or something, and she opened it up to put the next page in, and the wind blew her pages away, and she couldn't find them all. Another runner told me that he lost a couple of hours because he had the pages in a pocket on a belt around his waist, and somehow or another it came off. He lost the entire belt and had to go back on course to retrieve it. So all kinds of things can go wrong that cause these top runners to just fail to complete the course. But you have to admire everyone who goes there and makes these efforts. Like I say, a Barkley runner learns to redefine failure.
Yeah, I think
failure doesn't mean that you are not a good runner if you can't finish the Barkley, because the best runners can't finish the Barkley.
Yeah, and I think you mentioned there about weather as well. I've got a couple of questions, Ed, and can you let us know the land that Barkley is on? What kind of area does that cover? And also, you've mentioned about the elevation and the weather. What's so different about the weather? Is it scheduled to run at that time of year when it's absolutely hellish?
Yes, it is scheduled at the time of year when it almost always rains there. Over a span of 3 days, there's almost always rain.
Okay.
It tends to happen at night. The temperatures tend to be near freezing at night in those mountains. It's in a mountain range called the Cumberland Mountains. There's approximately a 2,000-foot vertical difference between the valleys, you know, where the streams are, mm-hmm. and the mountaintops. Most of the streams in that area are down around 1,300 feet above sea level, but the mountaintops are about 3,300 feet above sea level.
Okay.
So with that 2,000 feet of vertical difference, and it's steep, it's very steep. There's some places on the course where the climbs are approximately 1,600 feet of vertical gain per mile. And so the course is basically just a sequence of going from the streams at the bottom to the next mountaintop, and then down to another stream, and then back to the next, up to the next mountaintop. And the books tend to be hidden either at mountaintops or at down at the streams.
John's sitting here shaking his head. He's not too keen on running up hills. It's not quite his speciality. Although we do try to get him improving on it. I wanted to ask you something, Ed, and it was about the entry process for Barkley. It's a bit of a mythical thing, we know that, and I don't know how much you can give away or allude to what it consists of, but that rather unique entry process that Laz likes people to follow. Can you comment any on that?
Sure. It's quite simple, actually. There's a secret time that everyone who wants to get in is supposed to send Laz an email telling him why they should be allowed to run it. So the secret is the exact time to send that to Laz. That's what most people don't know. That's what I'm not going to tell.
Yeah.
I'm just saying. The secret is the time and date and email address and all of that to send your email to Laz and telling him why you should be allowed. Now, the important thing in that, in the telling him of why, is he's looking for the best runners, frankly. He looks for a few people who think they're good runners, but he thinks that they'll be embarrassed when they go to the Barkley. So he always chooses one person that he calls the human sacrifice. And so now the custom now is the human sacrifice gets bib number one, and that's the person that he is predicting will fail the worst.
That could be me, Ed. That could be me.
Really?
I'm saying I could be that sacrificial lamb. I could be that person 1 year. But is this the same as you mentioned in your book about having to write an essay? So is that tradition continued then? You've got to justify that your entry place in the Barkley Marathon.
Yeah, so now he uses people's entry email statements to try to select the best field. Now, he only is allowed to have 40 runners per year. That's his agreement with the Frozen Head State Park, because everybody has to camp out. That's another factor that makes this race especially difficult psychologically. The starting time is not known until 1 hour in advance. All you know is it's going to happen sometime in a 12-hour period between midnight and noon. And so everybody goes to bed in camp the night before, not knowing when they're going to have to start the race. Laz blows on a conch shell, a seashell, that he knows how to blow into it and make a loud honking sound. That's for everybody to wake up and get ready to start the race in 1 hour. But back to the, as to who he wants in the race, he's trying to get the best runners he can. The race is now very international. It's well known around the world. And so he tries to allow a good mixture of United States runners and international runners. He also is trying to get the best female runners, and there were a lot of good female runners this year. I think we're all hoping that someday there will be a female runner who's good enough to finish the Barkley. But, you know, this year there was an excellent runner there from England, Jasmine Paris.
Yeah.
She finished the fun run in about 39 and a half hours, I think it was. It's the first time in, I think that was the first time in 9 years that a woman finished the fun run. So again, this is just another statistical statement of how difficult the race is, that there are no woman has ever been able to finish four loops, let alone five, and it's only every few years that a woman can complete the fun run. But so most of the runners that Laz invites are elite runners, including alumni. Now, anytime the alumni is what he calls those 15 men who have finished the 100 miler, and they're always welcome to go back and try it again. There's only been two who have ever finished it more than once. Brett Mounty finished it twice. He holds the event record. He once finished it in 52 hours and a fraction. I think that's the only time anybody's ever broken 55 hours. In recent years, the finishes have all been around 58, 59 hours. So getting in is difficult, and Laz gets way more requests than he can allow, so that's part of why he keeps it secret. But there's a couple sure ways to get in. Laz also conducts other races. There's one called the Barkley Fall Classic. It's also held at Frozen Head. He calls it 50K. It's probably closer to 40 miles. And the winners of that, the male and female winners of the Barkley Fall Classic, are offered entry slots into the Barkley Marathons. Now, there's another type of race that Laz has invented. And by the way, I think when it comes to creating these endurance events, Laz is a genius, because he created this other race called the Big Backyard, of which there are now dozens of them throughout the world. And the format of that is every hour the runner has to complete 4 1/6 mile course and get back before the end of the hour, and then at the start of the next hour they must go out and do that again. So the 4 1/6 miles per hour corresponds to exactly 100 miles every 24 hours. He started having this race format several years ago, literally in his backyard. That's how it got the name. He owns some land in Tennessee that has some woods and some trails. And so people going round and round in his big backyard. And I was amazed when I first saw that race happening. Unfortunately, I'm way too old. There's no way I could maintain 100 miles per 24-hour pace for more than a couple hours. But it's amazing to see how that sport has exploded And there's so many races around the world now that follow that format, and the world record is something approaching 4 days. Runners are going up to, I think, 350 or 360 miles.
Yeah.
You know, and remember, this is very little sleep, because if you have to run 4 and 6 miles every hour, I mean, it's just, it's mind-blowing the what people can accomplish when they set out to do something that's at the limit of what's possible.
Yeah, I know that, and I'm quite intrigued by that statement about that, always pushing what's impossible. And in here in Scotland, there's a couple of backyard ultras taking place this year. We had some people on from Orkney. They're doing it up in Twat Farm. They're doing the backyard ultra. So it really is a global phenomenon now, isn't it?
Yes, and that's another one of Laz's inventions. So to me, it's another one that's designed to find out what is the limit of human endurance.
Yeah, and sorry, we went on to that, speaking about how you get a place in the Barclay Marathon. And for the people that win Laz's backyard, do they also get an entry place offered?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, that's one of the other things that he considers to be a strong credential, is that anyone who can go for multiple days in the big backyard format, he knows they're really good runners with great endurance and determination.
Yeah, I think I would just send an email, Ed.
Well, you might become the next human sacrifice.
That's a very good chance.
Be careful what you wish for.
So Ed, I want to bring it forward a little bit and speak about your return to the start line of the Barclay, which happened very recently for you after some illness. And I just wanted to understand how that felt for you to be back in the mix.
Thank you for asking that question. This is my favorite question of the day. For me to go back to the Barclay this year and to be able to participate again, it really meant a lot. See, it was a little over 3 years ago I was diagnosed with advanced prostate cancer. So, fortunately, I was able to get it treated. The treatments went on for 3 years. So, just late last year, I had finished the treatments. As far as I know, I'm now cancer-free. But that was sort of life-changing. You know, when you're staring death in the face with a diagnosis of cancer like that, and then you overcome it, thankfully for good medical care and people's prayers and the love I felt from all my friends and family, it just made me so happy to be there again. Laz allowed me to run it, not as a competitor, because he knows I can't do that anymore. I'm 74 years old. But he allowed me to enter it as a sweep, to stay at the back of the pack and just help any runners that I saw with problems. I was the only one that I saw having a problem. it felt so good to me to be out there. I did manage to get the first 5 books. My navigation was perfect. I went right straight to every book. I was with another so-called legacy geezer who has run the Barclay even more than I have, Leonard Martin. He and I were together for much of that first few hours. It took us, I think it was about 7.5 hours to get the first 5 books. At that point, I was so exhausted that I had to quit and went back to camp and gave a little speech there at the finish line. And I was telling people that was the happiest day of my life since the cancer diagnosis. It felt so good to be there again among all these great runners and to be able to do what I could. Certainly can't do anything like what I used to be able to do 30 some years ago, but just the love of life and being out there again, it felt so good to me. and it makes me recall part of what I think is a good prescription for life, for a life well lived. There's a three-word motto that I saw on a runner's t-shirt a few years ago. The three words are dream, plan, do. And if, you know, if we can live our lives like that, to dream about what we want to do, to decide what we want to do, and then pursue it by planning how to accomplish it, and then get out there and try it. I mean, that's a wonderful formula for life. I think something like that has to motivate everyone who aspires to be an ultra marathon runner. Laz wrote something that I thought was quite profound a couple years ago. He said, we should all dream big, but dreams are meaningless unless you have the willpower to prepare for it, to get out and earn it. So I endorse that philosophy. Dream big, figure out how to accomplish what you want, and go after it.
Yeah.
That's quite wonderful, and thank you very much for sharing that, Ed. And I love that dream, plan, do. That is that's a good t-shirt. You could make a fortune with them, definitely.
Somebody already has,
yeah. Can I ask as well, how many times have you lined up at the start, Ed?
22 times.
Wow.
Yep, I've started it 22 times, and the gentleman I mentioned a little while ago, Leonard Martin, he holds the record. He has started the Barkley 25 times.
Wow.
And he went a little further than I did this year. He's also a few years younger than I. But so he and I made it together to the fifth book, and at that point I said I need to head back to camp before I get further out there and not able to get back to camp. But he went on, he got the next book, but then he couldn't find the following book after that. So he eventually quit and shortcutted back to camp. So he ended up getting one book more than I did.
And Ed, what do you think keeps drawing people back? There's a lot of people who have done it, never completed it, but they feel drawn back to it. What draws a human being back to this sort of environment, do you think?
Well, it's just facing up to a huge challenge. Eventually, you come to accept that maybe you can't do it all, but at least the way I feel is I still want to go out there and see how much I can do. I mean, like, Every book page that I got was like a little celebration.
Yeah.
Serotonin reward rush in my brain to think, yes, I did it. I got another book. So even though you can't do it all, I think many people are drawn to see what their limit is and to get out there and do what you can and be proud of it.
Brilliant.
Fantastic.
Okay. How do you feel the race has changed from when it started to now?
Oh, my. Well, like I mentioned, back in the early days, it was very small. That was an average of 16 runners those first few years. But eventually it grew. So it went from being a very small race that very few people had ever even heard of and very few people were interested in. And of course, the course was easier. It didn't have as much vertical gain as it does now. It was easier to get in because all you had to do was send Gary Cantrell a self-addressed stamped envelope. and he would send you an entry form, and he would take your 50 cents. That's another thing that's changed about the race. You see, the first couple of years, it was only 50-cent entry fee. Now it's all the way up to $1.60. What does he think we are, millionaires?
Inflation.
Well, but anyway, so it went from being very small and very little reputation, but now it's huge. It's internationally famous. Oh, and one of the runners who first went there from England was an ultra-distance race walker named Ulrich Kamm, K-A-M-M. He was from Germany. He went there in 1990, and then he went back to Europe and he spread the word about this race. Uli, as he goes by, he published a couple times a year a list of all the ultramarathons in the world. He called it the International Fixtures List. At least he called it the German equivalent. An international list of all the ultramarathon events in the world. And that was how the race first became known throughout Europe. And in 1991, the Soviets sent a team of elite ultramarathon runners to the Barclay. This is described in my book, 1991. I call it the year of the Soviet invasion, because they sent a team of about 8 runners from various countries that comprised the Soviet Union. And it was really neat meeting them. But I'm happy to say that I beat them all. And so did 2 American women runners. That year, I think in the fun run, that was back in the days when no one was attempting to go beyond the fun run. But there were about 10 or 11 fun run finishers that year, including 2 of the Soviets. But I finished 4th that year, and then a couple of American women became the first women to finish the fun run, and then the Soviets, they were at the back of the pack.
Oh, fantastic.
But anyway, I think Uli Kamm, by publicizing about this event in his publication in Germany, that started its international reputation. But then over the years, there might only be 1 or 2 foreign runners enter the Barclay. But then everything got magnified in about 2014 or 15 when the documentary movie came out.
Yeah.
That really led to the explosion of the worldwide reputation of the Barclay. And so since then, there's been a whole lot more media. You know, there's film crews and writers and photographers there every year. So the Barclay has changed a lot since its early days when it was so small. Laz was begging runners to come and try it. Now he keeps it secret to keep the number of requests down so he can manage it.
And
so everything about the Barclay has changed. It's gotten harder. And that's, to me, the beauty of the Barclay is this evolution, that it has gotten harder because you keep trying to keep it at the limit of what's possible. And the limit of what's possible has been expanded because of the Barclay. It draws out the best mountain runners in the world. They come there. Anytime somebody finishes the 100, he makes it harder again. So now he's had to back off a little bit. No one's finished it in the last 5 years. And this year, the course was actually a little bit shorter and a little bit easier than the previous couple of years. And if you look at the results of this year, it had more people. Let me see. The finishing times of loops 1, 2, and 3 among the best few runners was faster this year than in the past several years. And this year, the number of runners to start loop 2, it was 36 runners out of a field of 40. That was the most ever to start loop 2. And I think it's because not only did he have a world-class field of starters this year, but because the runners are getting better, and he did shorten the course a little bit this year compared to the last couple of years. So he's tampering with that limit of human ability, and in response, the race has gotten tougher over the years, which to me proves that the runners are getting better.
Yeah. Can I ask a question, Ed? It's around about the big names. Now, we hear a lot about the Barclay now. It's easy to go onto YouTube and watch videos about it. The media circus has definitely arrived in town, and there's social media, so even us here in Scotland, we can easily access content. And I wondered about, is there any names that we maybe don't hear about that are behind the scenes that make the experience amazing every year?
Well, of course, Laz is the biggest name. He puts in an incredible amount of time and effort into making the Barclay happen every year. So he deserves, you know, a great amount of credit for what he's done, in my opinion. I don't even know all the names of some of the other people that I think are the key to the Barclay being what it is today, and that is the officials of the park, Frozen Head State Park. For many years, the superintendent of the park didn't like the Barclay. He tried to get it shut down. This is the story of this is in my book, Tales from Out There. I think it was around 2006, some officials with the state park attempted to shut down the Barclay. They claimed it was not an appropriate use of public land that was supposed to be a natural area. But then a few years ago, the management of the park changed. There's a new park superintendent now, and he loves the Barclay. And all the rangers, the officials who work at the park, without them, this wouldn't be happening. And so I think they're some of the really key people behind the fact that the Barclay is what it is. It's because the park now accepts it. They welcome the runners. They cooperate with Laz, not only to allow the Barclay marathons every year, but also the Barclay Fall Classic that I mentioned. Now, the Barclay Fall Classic, they allow up to 500 runners. So if there's anybody out there who wants to get a taste of the Barclay, but you can't get into the real race because it's too small and because you're not world class, you should go run the Barclay Fall Classic. Now, but even that race books up to its capacity months in advance, and you might be able to get on a waiting list, but go to Frozen Head Park and run the Barclay Fall Classic. And then even if you can't do that, you can always go to Frozen Head State Park and run around the perimeter loop. Gary calls that the Barclay Challenge Loop. There's about a 21-mile loop of trails. These are legal official trails of the park that anyone can use. You see, one of the park rules is that you must stay on trails. Park visitors must stay on the trails. The reason they instituted that rule is because over the years, a lot of people would go out to those mountains and they would start bushwhacking off trail, and then they would need to have helicopter search and rescue and things like that. So that's why the park made the rule that runners must stay on trails. So they work with Laz to waive that rule for the Barclay Marathons. And in the Barclay Marathons, we are allowed to go off trail on the prescribed course, but that's just one time a year exception to the rule. But anyway, I think some of the very important people that we don't hear about are those Frozen Head State Park officials. They're great people, and I think they deserve a lot of credit. A couple other names I want to mention. Laz's wife, Sandra, she supports him in putting on the race, and there's a lot of work that she does. It's always nice to see her there every year. But also, one man in particular, I think, deserves a lot of credit for the modern Barclay experience is Hiram Rogers. Hiram is a geologist who lives near Frozen Head. I think he lives in Knoxville, Tennessee, maybe works in Oak Ridge. And Hiram, he's an expert hiker. He's published multiple books about hiking at various places in the United States. And he's the one who goes out to Frozen Head with the author. authorization from the Rangers to explore and help create the Barkley course. So, you know, he's another one of the evil geniuses, I guess you could call him, who explores the mountains and then recommends to Laz the course changes that Laz keeps making to keep this thing out there at that limit of human capability. So I think Hiram Rogers deserves a lot of credit.
Oh, yeah.
And then there's Rich Lamacher. He's another guy who's been going to the Barkley for many, many years. But he plays the important role of cooking the Barkley chicken. So we need to mention Rich Lamacher as one of the big names behind the scenes at Barkley because he cooks the chicken. But, you know, all the runners who go there, big names and people that we've all the people we've never heard of, big names and little names, I guess you could say, they're all heroes to me because anybody willing to put themselves out there and do the best they can against the world's toughest trail race, I think they all deserve a lot of credit.
Thank you very much for that, Ed. And you know what we're going to do is, in our show notes, we're going to put in a link to where people can buy your book, Tales from Out There, the Barkley Marathon, the world's toughest trail race. But can I say, our time's getting cut short here. Can I say thank you very much for your time? Well, I was going to say it's this evening.
You're
welcome. It's this evening for us, but I know it's midday for yourself, so I'm going to hand over to Stephen as well.
Yeah, just Ed, I want to thank you for giving up your time and entertaining us with your wisdom, your knowledge, and your on-the-ground experience in Frozen Head State Park. John and I often talk about it and how much a dream of ours is even just to go and visit that part of the world because of the almost the folklore that exists there. And it's guys like yourself that are inspiring us to do so. So it's been an absolute privilege for us to get the chance to speak to you, and we really, really appreciate it.
Well, thank you for those kind words. I appreciate it, and I enjoyed this. I thank you for the opportunity and for interviewing me.
Thank you, Ed. Take care, my man.
Thank you very much, Ed. We really appreciate it.
Okay. You're welcome.
Okay.
What about that then, listeners? Hopefully you enjoyed that chat with Frozen Ed Furtaw as much as Steve and I did when we were recording it. We were totally blown away by how humble and informative Ed was, and want to thank him again for taking the time to speak with us and speak so articulately about, better than I did, about the Barkley Marathons. It was a great chat, wasn't it, Stephen?
Oh, it was entrancing. You know, just letting Ed speak and tell us all about his own experiences at Barkley, a 22-time Barkley veteran, first ever finisher. You know, you're speaking legends.
100%. For our new listeners, go back and listen to a few episodes and you'll find out what that means. But we should also say, and it's only right that we give Ed's book a plug. Ed's book is Tales from out there being out there at Barkley, and that's available. We'll put the link in the show notes so you can link up with that.
We will indeed. Yeah, the show notes will have the link so you can purchase Ed's book, and it's well worth a read if that has whetted your appetite and you're looking to bathe yourself in more Barkley content, because it can be quite addictive.
Most definitely. We'd also love to give a wee plug to for our episode with Graham Connolly that sets the context. We said that in the intro, but it sets the context for this conversation. But Graham gives a wee bit of, not too much, but a bit of an insight into life in the campsite for that few days when the Barkley Marathons are up and active.
Yeah, that was last week's episode, so season 5, episode 5. So if you've enjoyed this one, go back and give that one a listen. And you also hear a wee bit more from John and I in that one, and maybe get a wee flavour as to what the Young Hearts Run Free podcast is all about, because we didn't take ourselves too seriously. We're pretty light-hearted and relatable. We kind of cover running in general, 5Ks, probably focus on ultra marathons, but we may speak about what we eat rather than what we wore on our feet.
Can someone with any day? another dialect there, Ken. Something that we didn't do very often, Stephen, is tell folk how they can get in touch with us, how they can engage with us. What's the best way for listeners to...
Yeah, well, as they say, we like getting reached out to. That's what they say these days. So you can reach out to us on Twitter at YHRFpod. Give us a follow, give us a message, give us a tweet. Or we are also on Instagram, Young Hearts Run Free Podcast. And yeah, again, we're reasonably active on both these platforms, and we do like a wee chin wag with people who get in touch. So yeah, give us a follow and give us a shout.